and generally in the world and among lawyers who care about the law, a lot of attention paid to the state of law schools, to what kind of, you know, what law students are like these days, what law students are learning. Law firms, there's a lot of attention on that, obviously on the judiciary as well, law clerks, et cetera. But I think most on this panel being in-house lawyers and, you know, a great assist, you know, helper of in-house lawyers in Herald here, we would, you know, raise our hand to say that the in-house counsel is an important, very important area to think about the state of the legal profession. You know, as I think about it, this is a couple reasons. One is, you know, so don't forget about the in-house counsels. In-house counsel are, as I always see it, it's really a dual-hatted responsibility. One is the general counsel or chief legal officer, whatever the title is responsible for the legal advice that's given to the company and its executives, and is, you know, runs the legal department, of course, and that's the fundamental of the job. But in most companies, and certainly that's true of all of our panelists here today, the general counsel is also a core member of the management team. And that is, you know, so in that capacity, you weigh in on a lot of issues that have, you know, some legal element to them, or maybe not. Could be a cultural element internally, could be a business decision element. Do we roll out this product? What should we do? And you're expected to be a contributing member of that management team. And I think this is why I think it's so important to think about who are in-house lawyers today. What are the values that in-house lawyers bring to the companies? How do they think about their roles? And why should we, as outsiders and as outsiders to a given company, but as people who care deeply about the state of the legal profession, why should we think about in-house counsel? To me, it's that these can be very important positions in corporations and can have a lot of influence, not just on the corporation, but on social issues around them, for better and for worse. We'll get into that. That's a little bit of the topic today. But also the state of an industry, the state of regulation, depending on how, you know, depending on what values and what philosophies the in-house counsel, the general counsel is bringing to the table. So the Federalist Society, as John was saying, has been doing this in-house counsel project for the last few years. And I think that it's important on its own and also extremely relevant to the idea of the current state of the legal profession. We should think about, you know, how do our fellow GCs and in-house lawyers approach their jobs, and what can we do as the society to help inform that decision-making, help them, you know, bring the right approach to the job. You know, I think the topic today, I think, sits well at this intersection of those dual hats of general counsels. On the one hand, you know, today we're obviously talking about, you know, the topic is, the headline is navigating business challenges in red and blue states. Okay, so we're obviously talking about conflict of laws and dealing with conflict of laws, whether they're inconsistent laws or laws that are in tension with each other, or sometimes laws that are in outright conflict with each other across jurisdictions, is one of the core things you do as an in-house lawyer. If you're operating in many states, as most are, if you've got physical plants in many states, employees in many states, you sell product in many states, also overseas, you have multinational corporations. This is core to what each of the panelists does in her and his day jobs. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll start with a little bit of the blocking and tackling about resolving and dealing with these issues as a general counsel, and how they go about that in their day-to-day core legal work. But then there's the other aspect that I mentioned, which is the corporate leadership aspect. And there I think we get into, you know, what might be the sexier aspect of this, you know, the more controversial aspect, but the red and blue state. So it's not just, you know, different minimum wage law between two states, but there are increasingly in America instances where states may impose different requirements on companies, or it might be a state federal thing. One of those that comes to mind, for example, is the Texas and Florida, think about the tech sector, the Texas and Florida anti-censorship laws, which, you know, Fifth Circuit upheld the Texas one, 11th Circuit strikes down the Florida one. We'll see where that goes, but there seems to be at least some tension with the requirement of the Texas law, now stayed, but there it's some tension between that and what DHS apparently is pushing tech companies to do, which is engage in more censorship. So that's one example of state-federal distinctions in a pretty hot-button area. And there, I think, that's where, to bring it home, that's where the general counsel has a legal perspective on this, but also since corporations, as we say in the blurb, since corporations are also often pushing these rules, this is a place where general counsels can have a huge impact on what rules are being adopted in states, whether they're being challenged or not challenged. And so this is a case where the GC's role as management member and determiner, co-determiner of culture within a company and approach to some external issues is very important. We're privileged today to have a great panel. As I say, I'll go alphabetically. Full bios are in the are on the website, so you can take a look at them. They're too long to read. We'd take the full time just reading their very impressive bios. But going alphabetically, at my far left, Chad Boudreau is at Huntington Ingalls Industries, HII, general counsel there, chief legal officer there. And he also has held senior positions at DOJ and DHS, among other important stops in his career prior to going to HII. Alphabetically, next up in the middle here is Beth Collins, and she is probably the most interesting tagline on the whole roster, but is the former general counsel of WWE, and I had to do a double take. It's like, that's not World Wildlife? No, it actually is the World Wrestling. Yeah. Exactly. WWE as in the wrestling WWE. So Beth was general counsel there. She was assistant AG for heading up the Office of Legal Policy at the Justice Department, among prior stops. She's also been in-house at Caterpillar, including overseas, dealing with some of the international issues, as well as at Boeing earlier in her career. Next, we've got just to my left here, Harold Kim. And Harold is the Chief Legal Officer and EVP at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and has also worked in the Bush White House and prior to that as a Senate staffer. And so has that perspective on it of both executive branch and legislative branch on the questions today. And finally, last but not least, Cheryl Stanton. She is the general counsel. She's the chief legal and government affairs officer of Brightstar Care. And in the past, among other notable stops, she was at the Department of Labor, heading up the wage and hour division at DOL in the Trump administration, correct? So with that, I'll turn it over. We'll go first with Harold, then we're going to go to Beth, and then Cheryl, and then last, Chad, with some opening remarks, then we'll kick it off to discussion. If you have a question, I want to make this interactive, so if you have a question or something prompts you to want to intervene, raise your hand, and if the timing seems right, I'll call on you, and if not, we may defer it till later, but do not hesitate, and please bring some good questions. And if they're very controversial, they'll all send them back to me. So, all right, Harold, thanks.
Great, thanks, Ted. Thanks a lot, Dean, for the invitation. Before I dive into this, I just got to say, these stickers are just off the charts, and my teenage daughter is going to love these. So I thought I would level set as to, why are we talking about this? What is the interest of the business community when it comes to what we're facing from the litigation, regulatory, compliance world? And I think in the last 5-10 years, you have seen a greater balkanization of standards and regulations. It could be a blue state, could be a red state, could be a purple state. But then layering on top of that are the regulations that you're seeing here coming from Washington. And then on top of that is what you're seeing internationally. And I think it's become incredibly challenging for companies to try and navigate these waters in terms of, where are the guideposts? How do we structure our compliance programs in a way that follows the rules, that doesn't get us into trouble? And it's becoming increasingly more complicated day by day. I mean, I can tell you, in-house counsel, they're spending a whole lot of time trying to figure out a regulatory regime from California, how that juxtaposes itself with Texas or Florida. And you look at data privacy laws, for example. Europe several years ago came out with a GDPR, and then that sort of got imported into California with their CCPA. Other states are coming up with various proposals on data privacy, and there's just really no uniformity or consistency in terms of how companies are managing their data. What are those obligations? And so, yeah, it is a conflict of laws issue. But as we step back, you know, if we look at how companies operate here in the U.S., and when we go back to first principles, it's really about trying to create more predictability, more stability, and it's really about reinforcing the rule of law, because without a stable rule of law, it is virtually impossible to have a vibrant free enterprise system. And so that's why the chamber, other business associations are fighting in the states, fighting in Washington, fighting the Biden regulatory agenda, you know, to try and advance really important principles like preemption. Certainly the Supreme Court is going to be considering, you know, a challenge to a California law that basically tells pork producers in other states on how to raise their hogs. And so this is becoming increasingly more acute. I think the court is going to have something to say about it, but this is not going to go away anytime soon, especially as national political ideologies continue to intensify, again, in blue states, red states, and purple states. And something that I can assure you that at least my organization, the Chamber, is dedicated to confronting on behalf of our members, because there is a chorus of concern as to where this is potentially headed and what this could do to our free enterprise system on a much more macro scale.
Thanks, Harold.
So, Harold, thank you. As Ted mentioned, both of us are alums of the Bush administration, and it's great to kind of get the band back together. It's also depressing that we're getting the band back together to sing some of the same songs, and I think you're right that the phenomenon that we're talking about today is getting worse and not better. So, you know, where this really came home for me was when I was at Caterpillar during the pandemic, and that's a company with 900 facilities around the world, manufacturing facilities, you know, in several states, and looking not just at the number of jurisdictions that may or may not overlap, that felt that they had the authority to regulate companies and their employees, but also the different types of regulators, so health regulators or localities, and just the sheer number of regulations or purported regulations that were coming at us from all sides. And so that's when I added something to my list of things that keep me up at night as a general counsel, and I think everyone has those lists. And it's not one I think I would have had 15 or 20 years ago, but it's simply missing a change in the law. Like just literally not being up to speed on what the applicable legal requirements might be. And it might be because there's so many laws, or because of the charming phenomenon of regulatory policy making by enforcement. And so being on the lookout for all of these and trying to figure it out is just a Herculean task. So I'll take a moment to give the shout out for all of the law firms that do the client alerts. Thank you. Thank you very much for people who think they do not matter and people are not reading. We do. And thank you, and keep doing them. So, you know, you first of all have to be aware that the law is changing, and it's a lot harder than it seems. And if you're at a global company, you know, like Caterpillar, you rely on herds and teams of people. But you also are relying on your legislative affairs colleagues. And that's where that teamwork comes into place, that a successful company is going to have folks with different skill sets and with different expertise. And a good legislative affairs team is absolutely one of the best assets that a company can have. Then when you see the laws coming or the changes in policy coming, you're going to have a decision point of how to engage, or really increasingly, I think, if you want to engage at all in the legislative process. And this is where I come to another factor that I've seen increasingly, and this is both because of having been in-house in a number of countries and advised, you know, like at WilmerHale, tons of major corporations. You know, I think that there is such an increasing cynicism, unfortunately, about the United States government, like the federal, the state, and the local governments. There's this cynicism that you might find within your not just legal colleagues, but across the management teams. And it's flat out demoralizing. As someone who looks at my time in public service as the greatest privilege that I had, to hear people around the world lumping the United States government in with governments that I wouldn't want us to be on the same list on, because of the matter of trust. And so what does that mean for this conversation? It means that cynicism and that fear, it's fear of regulatory retaliation. And I think that's a really significant factor when you're working in-house and you are attempting to convince your colleagues that this may be a regulatory risk that you need to weigh in on. And I think a lot of companies simply choose not to weigh in because of this concern of regulatory retaliation. Or you end up making the policy case in a command performance in front of angry legislatures or from an absolute like defensive crouch in the midst of an enforcement action. And that's suboptimal to good public discourse, but it's something that I saw with increasing frequency over the last 10 years. You know, and if you are, if you're gonna engage, you have to make sure that your colleagues in that management team, that you have the right process to get the buy-in, because the decision of whether or not to engage is almost never going to be for the lawyers. You provide advice and you have an opinion, but you are likely not going to be the decision maker. And there are times, I actually read this, and the notion that a corporation would have a point of view on something also sort of jumped out at me, and I was like, that's not how that works. So one, without getting into details, and I think all of us will avoid details of prior or current jobs, but you could imagine that on drone policy, for example, Boeing Defense, which manufactures drones, might have a slightly different point of view than Boeing Commercial, which has an incredibly healthy fear of drones in commercial airspace. And so just making sure that you have the right mechanisms in place internally to get those viewpoints from your colleagues is critical. You're also gonna run into competing priorities really, really fast. And it's not just like the substantive priorities of where a company may wanna spend their political capital, it's time. It is the time of the senior leadership and getting them to focus, because regulatory risk is often viewed as a tomorrow problem or a next year problem, but that stupid shipment of widgets that is not arriving today or tomorrow, and what can we do to our supplier to get those things here, that's a today problem. And so trying to get your voice onto those tomorrow problems is something that takes a lot of work and effort. You will, though, get opportunities to join amicus briefs. And here I'll give the shout out to the trade associations. Like, they are really doing God's work in a lot of cases where companies don't feel that they're in a position to take a stand, although good luck on associational standing. I know you need one, company. But there's a lot of companies that just don't want to be the tall sunflower. And I think that's a regrettable situation, because I also think if you look at the percentages on issues of companies that are willing to be out front, it tends to tilt, just to put on Captain Obvious hat for a moment. And so it's a regrettable aspect of today's discourse. Now, I will say, for all the folks who come to in-house folks and say, sign our amicus briefs, one pro tip for you that really sticks with me is, if you're going to cite something for a factual assertion, please do not make it the New York Times op-ed page. Just don't. That's an easy way to get into the no pile immediately. So then you have the next step in the cycle. So the regulatory change is gonna happen, and then you're gonna have to find a way to comply with this. And it sounds simple, and it is absolutely not. Even in well-run companies and ethical companies that want to do the right thing. And one thing that you will find is you work with people, business folks, who weigh risk every day. And one of the risks that they view as, can view as just another risk, is risk of enforcement. And so you may end up in a situation of, well, yeah, but are they really gonna come after us? So that law passes, but we'll just keep doing what we're, and these are well-meaning people who just feel like you can weigh that risk. I won't even get into the paper trail that that can generate, which is just god awful in the case of enforcement. But it's a dangerous path. And as a lawyer, it is your job to make sure there are some risks that you just don't get to assume as a company. And choosing not to comply with applicable regulatory regime is one of those risks. And I won't get into the details. I feel like I'm going a little bit long. I thought you were going 5 to 8 minutes. You went 2. And
yeah, like, less is more. Less is more, right?
Thanks, Harold. Sure, I'll just carry this ball. Like, yeah, here we go. But I was, you know, chief compliance officer for Caterpillar for a while. And, you know, you've got to make sure when you are looking at this really changing regulatory environment that you leverage technology where you can. Like, that's critical, but it's also difficult because it's so much better to leverage the technology on the front end, not as an add-on. And as the rules keep changing, you got add-ons to add-ons to add-ons, but you got to keep trying. You got to educate your people. The vast majority of mistakes are mistakes. They are not active malfeasance, but you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt from most regulators. They'll just assume if you're a world-class company, you knew what you were doing. And oftentimes people are just trying to do the right thing. You need to make your compliance program auditable because you may see enforcement coming through right after the next year as you're implementing this. It has to be flexible. And you absolutely have to have the tone from the top because your business colleagues are going to be exhausted. They are going to be tired of the ever-changing regulatory environment. And they may or may not start referring to you as Little Black Cloud when you come in the room to explain to them the next horrible regulation that is coming down. But you have to keep fighting that internally. And people do want to do the right thing. And I know we'll talk a little bit more about sort of red state and blue state. But my personal view is, it is absolutely obligation of a board or management of a company to look at a state and ask, is it worth it for this company given the tax regime or given the flavor of the month approach to regulation or the sheer hostility to corporations? You know, I think it's incumbent on management to think, is this a state where we want to be doing business in? Or maybe we can go down the road somewhere where they don't actively demonize corporations on a daily basis. Wouldn't that be a nice situation to be in? But these conversations need to be on the basis of your legal advice and interpretation that at that moment in time is unbiased and is straightforward so that your colleagues can make informed decisions. That's not the time to bring your personal politics to the table unless you're 1,000% transparent about it. But it's hard. It's hard. You should do something about that. The chamber needs
this,
to...
This is like therapy for me. Just to come here and, you know.
Y'all need to do something about this. But all right, well, I went the allotted time.
Beth, just in the interest of kind of encouraging interruptions and questions,
I'll
interrupt you with a couple. One is, you know, I think to your last point about being straight down the middle and not letting your bias come in when you're giving your legal advice, I think it is, you know, I talked about the two hats. It's very important to separate those hats.
Yes.
So are you, I mean, and sometimes overtly, I am speaking from as a lawyer, I'm telling you this is risky because there's this new regulation, or if we do this, we can get, there could be some breach of contract claim against us. That's a pure legal point. Now, let me put that hat on this side and get over here. I think we should still do this because the penalty, this is marginal. I think if somebody comes after us, we'll win that case. This is important enough as a business matter that we need to proceed and build this product or take this chance. You got to separate those. I think a lot of in-house lawyers, I think, let those bleed into each other because you carry a heavy stick as a lawyer. And if you come in and say, you know, the black regulatory cloud person every time, no, we can't do this because of this. There's some rules that you're not going to break, obviously securities fraud, et cetera. We're not talking
That's
about
bad.
Those, but I'm talking about, you know, things where there's at the margin, hey, is this covered by the GDPR? Is this covered by California's rule? You know, if you come in too quickly, and I've seen this because somebody doesn't like a product innovation.
Yes.
Right. The lawyer will say, no, we can't do that. That's illegal. And then you lose all credibility with the rest of the company and the management team.
If you're doing well, you'll get the invitation that says, I want your counsel, not just as a lawyer, but on the business side of it. And the best advice I got was just make sure you tell me which one it is.
Yeah. Right.
Because there are many people who will feel they have to follow your legal advice and never, ever cloak your business advice in legal advice. Because that is a way that lawyers get into big trouble in-house, and they should. Because it's a great place to be in to be a part of the conversation on the should we do it any or should we do it or how and what's the customer impact? Do we have the supply chain for it? But if they don't know if you're giving legal advice or not, they're going to stop inviting you to the table.
Yep. Cheryl. Thank you, Beth. Cheryl, over to you.
Thanks, Ted. And I have to tell you now, I'm exhausted after listening to Howard and particularly Beth rethinking this role. But I am the Chief Legal and Government Affairs Officer for a franchise system called Bright Star Care. I highlight that because I end up with a third hat, and that's the advocacy, government affairs, when do we get involved hat. And by way of background, Bright Star Care is home care. We'll sit with grandma to make sure she doesn't fall, personal companion care. We'll help her with light touching, hair washing, things of that nature, personal care. We will do some very sophisticated skill in home, whether it's infusion work, whether it is wound treatment. We also are involved with a number of pilots across the country where they bring the hospital to you. So when you are admitted to the hospital shows up in your room and provide the nursing caregivers in that situation, as well as we're at the cutting edge of a number of the clinical trials on many of the vaccines, boosters, things of that nature. So we run the gambit in terms of acuity and care. I explain all that because I get extra layers, right? So when am I the lawyer for the brand and when am I the lawyer for the franchisor? Plus, then I have the whole advocacy. When I'm the advocacy for the brand, when am I the advocacy for the franchisees? When are we locked up together? When do I put the legal hat on, advocacy hat, all that? And we'll explore some of that as the day goes on. I wanted to focus on kind of two additional points that came up by looking at two areas of law. First, employment law. I am an employment lawyer by background. In addition to being at the federal DOL, I ran the state equivalent of DOL in South Carolina and had what we call the labor and employment portfolio in the Bush administration, the White House counsel's office for the last 2 years. And so I kind of grew up in the employment law world, and it's fascinating to me the shift. Oh, and I should mention I'm a second generation management lawyer. So I really grew up with employment law, listening to my dad talk about it at the dinner table. I thought that's what you talked about over dinner. Little did I know. So it's this really interesting evolution of it. It was all federal. I mean, in the 30s, you got the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, federal laws. In the 60s, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act come into play. The 70s bring you OSHA. I can never remember what that stands for. We all know what OSHA is at this point. As well as the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, otherwise known as ERISA. And then eventually in 1990, we get the Americans with Disabilities Act. I highlight that because labor and employment law started in the federal forum. I mean, some of these laws, to Harold's point, preempt state law. So you're always going to be in federal court. So really in the 80s and 90s, particularly as wage and hour cases evolved and as anti-discrimination, anti-harassment cases evolved, it was all in federal court. Except in New Jersey, which is kind of where I grew up as a young lawyer, they had something called the Law Against Discrimination, which had been on the books since 1945, very early. One of the most comprehensive anti-discrimination, anti-harassment laws in the country, even to this day, and the plaintiffs' counsel started suing under that law, which was really unusual. And not only suing under it, but I remember as a young attorney a while ago, the plaintiffs' bar, someone got up at a meeting and said, it is malpractice if you as a plaintiff's lawyer file a complaint that can be removed to federal court. Because the state remedies, the state law, the state forum is so much better for your clients that if you're in federal court, you just put yourself at a disadvantage. So think about that. And at that time, you started to see some federal cases have state law add-ons, but New Jersey, it was leading the way. Well, the plaintiffs bar nationally started taking a look at this. Some big cases came out of New Jersey. The first age discrimination win against IBM was a state law claim out of New Jersey. And those lawyers and some others became leaders and thought leadership for the plaintiffs bar in employment law. And so you started to see more and more cases being brought under state law. And then they took it the next step. Particularly in the after they saw some of the Bush administration regulations and employment law, certainly after the Trump rules and regulations. I sat on a panel when I was at Wage and Hour, and a plaintiff's attorney, who was very frustrated at what she was hearing, just blurted out, "That's why we're going to state courthouses. We're going to fight the employment law fight now only at the state level." And so it's this opposite of what we want to see as in-house counsel of uniformity, and more where now we have the blue states, the red states, and California, right? So I think, unfortunately, now that we see things like the major question doctrine coming out with, from the Supreme Court, the reemergence of the non-delegation doctrine, my fear is that employment law is only going to get worse, not better. The second point I want to make is sometimes I think the red state, blue state is not as predictive as we think it's going to be. As I mentioned, home care, home care itself is a little, only 38 states have any license for companion care or personal care. So think about that. Someone needs a license to cut your grandmother's hair, but they don't need a license to sit with them alone all day long. And I'm not a big licensure person, but I would think, you know, some quality. And our motto is a higher standard of care. We always have nurse RN oversight of any kind of care. There's care planned by an RN for all of our clients with periodic assessments. We are Joint Commission accredited, which if you've heard of that, that accredits many of your hospitals and other medical practices. We helped Joint Commission create that accreditation in the home care space because we felt so strongly in showing that standard of care. So the idea of licensure, we understand with some, you know, moderation. That being said, what is really interesting is on the acute side, the skilled care side of healthcare generally. The southern red states all have this concept, not all, some have moved back from it, but historically have had this concept of certificate of need. And that is before you can go get a skilled license, often because you are building a hospital or investing in heavy, expensive medical equipment, you need to go prove to the state that there is need in that area before they will give you a skilled license. Now, the genesis of this is the idea that you need to make sure your rural communities have hospitals too. You don't just want all of this expensive investment being in medical care being in the cities and the areas of populations, but that rural communities have it too. The challenge is by the time we're in you know, post-pandemic, post-telehealth, post many different things, what has become is a barrier to entry in some instances, because what happens is those who have the licenses are happy. And so if you come in and say there's a need for this care, and they apply to things like skilled home care. Well, there's no investment in equipment. There's no bricks and mortar, right? We're coming to you. And so this is something that has become a really big fight if you watch the southern states. Florida did kind of move totally away from CON, but you've got it in South Carolina, massive fight in our General Assembly last year. I mean, that's a fascinating of who was an ally and who wasn't in ways it just makes me laugh to think about. Tennessee, we see it happening, other states as well. Kentucky just did away with it. And so red state, blue state is not always indicative of business friendly or not. It really can depend. And so, you know, I'll end, because I probably have gone too long as well, with just, you know, a thought on not only do I think it's super important, the client alerts, as Beth talks about, those are incredibly important. I can't tell you how much I lean on my trade associations. I lean on my trade associations to alert me when some change in the regulations happening. Like I said, home care licensing, there is a different conversation in every state house every time I turn around. And unless someone comes and tells me, I don't know what's happening. The other thing that I find them very, very, very valuable for is going to the state house and talking for us. Because when the legislators hear that it's not a Bright Star care problem, but it is a home care industry problem that's going to impact grandma's ability to be taken care of in home, suddenly the light, you know, the eyes light up and they hear more.
Strength in numbers.
Very much. Right. Not just as a shield, but as a force.
Multiplier.
Right. Yes.
Right. Right, Chad, the author. Right, explain that one, Chad.
Promoting my books.
Yeah,
available now online. I'm Chad Boudreau, and
when I gave your bio. The author. Yeah.
I work for Huntington Ingalls. Some of you may know Huntington Ingalls. We're the largest employer in Mississippi and the largest industrial employer in Virginia. You can't have two diabolically opposed laws from two states like those two. So this is a familiar topic for me. Huntington Ingalls builds warships first and foremost. We're the only builder of aircraft carriers. We also build nuclear submarines and other cool things that equip our heroes. So it's a really interesting company. And as a part of this company, we deal with all sorts of different legal issues. We deal with them at the state level, but mostly at the federal level. And I think, you know, in the spirit of our conversation here, the two things that I want to focus on, or I guess the one thing that I would focus on at the start is, we talk about the differences and the tensions in the laws, but to what end? That begs the question, how do you succeed in this environment? And I think when we think about how we succeed in this environment, we first need to think about what Ted was talking about at the get-go, which was the role of the general counsel or chief legal officer. That's changed. So I think Ben Heineman from GE was one of the original trailblazers of the new and improved general counsel. And we've seen others. I see some familiar faces in here. Many of you worked with Jay Stevens when he was the associate attorney general. He went on to work for Raytheon, a very strong chief legal officer within that business. And then you have others like Julie Sweet, who is now the CEO of Accenture, a very strong general counsel before that. And it's these thought leaders that have really done a good job of embedding themselves in the business. And that's really where the rubber hits the road if you want to succeed in mitigating risk. And the role of the general counsel will always be, first and foremost, mitigating risk of the company. You got to get the risk out of the company as best as you can. There are other roles now as well. Lawyer, statesperson is a role, and then business partner is the other role. You do have to be mindful of business advice versus legal advice. But if you're not in the business game, then you're not making a difference. You just aren't. And so that's something that for those of you who want to become general counsels, when they're interviewing you, you need to be interviewing your CEO or your potential CEO or your COO, and you need to be asking questions about how they think about their lawyers. Because quite frankly, those of us who aren't lawyers, those who aren't lawyers in the business, for the most part, they're highly allergic to lawyers. They don't want to deal with us. And why would they? Because in their normal worlds, the only time you need a lawyer is if you have a bad accident or you're getting a divorce or somebody's about to die. So when you're in a business, they don't really think, unless they've been trained to work with lawyers, unless they've seen the value before, they're not going to think about bringing a lawyer in. For me, it was very interesting when I started at Huntington Ingalls. I had a very strong CEO. My CEO at the time was a former Navy submariner. And the Navy they deal with nuclear materials. They're very top-down, compliance-oriented. There was a guy named Admiral Rickover who instilled all sorts of principles in the Navy that carry on into our business. But my boss at the time said, Chad, I don't want the law department to be the arthritis in the business. And I said, meaning, don't just tell me no. And I said, that requires a transaction between us and the business. And that is, in order for us to excel, in order for us to carry the business and make the business faster and not say no, we have to be embedded in the business. We have to be a part of the meetings, and we have to be at the beginning of discussions from the very beginning. And so that resonated, and it's worked. And it's worked famously because I have a law department of 50, about 30 lawyers, and each of my lawyers is embedded in his or her business. And they know everything that's going on, and they're called upon as teammates. And so if they see a direction from the very beginning that's not going to work from a regulatory standpoint, they'll raise their hand at that point and say, hey, why don't we try something different? Or at least they'll put things in place to mitigate the impediments that they're going to have going down that particular path. So that's something that's very important for lawyers. So I think the role of the lawyer is very important. If you don't have that right relationship with your client and the client doesn't understand the value that you have to bring, then you're not going to be successful, whether or not you're dealing with multi-jurisdictional issues or otherwise. The other thing that was touched upon by Beth was a compliance program. And one of the things that we did at Huntington Ingalls that has been very good for us and our community, quite frankly, is we built a compliance program that you could actually touch. It was more than just you know, the training and the policies and the procedures and the tone at the top. You need all that. That's the backbone of a compliance program. But we built compliance plans. We had core elements that outline what the legal doctrine was that we were talking about. And we had the business own compliance, which is probably the hardest thing to do. But again, I benefited from these Rickover principles I was talking about, because ownership in the Navy is all, it's a big thing. So I now have leaders in my company who run compliance councils, and they're not practicing law. We're there to equip them with all the legal requirements that they need. But I guarantee you, I can stand up, my chief compliance officer can stand up, and we can say, you need to do this. And for the most part, people will listen to us. It may take them a while. If one of the presidents of the business unit gets up and says it, it gets done immediately. Mm-hmm. And so that's been very good for us. One of the things that I did when I was chief compliance officer is we had, we would meet, my company meets every year in Atlanta, which is kind of equidistant from our two shipyards. And we bring all the vice presidents and presidents in, and it's about 70 of us. So it's the most important time that we have in our company. And talk about good tone at the top. When I was first working to build this new compliance program, because we were a 125-year-old company that started being a public company 11 years ago, we had to build our own compliance program. My CEO said, you need to brief my team on, you need to brief the entire company leadership on compliance and the compliance program. And the great tone at the top that he had at the time was, he said, do you want me to help you brief it? And so I had the CEO standing with me, which really resonated to the team how important it was at the very top. But one of the things that I did as a part of that was I wrote, who is the customer on a board? And they know who their customer is. The customer is the Navy. It's the Coast Guard. Inside the Navy, it's NAVC, it's Soup Ship. Those are the most important people in that world. And DCA is another part of that world for them. And I drew a line, and I said, the customer also includes DOJ, SEC, suspension and debarment official, all these people in my world that are very important. They're still the customer, same as the Navy piece of it. Now, for those of us who worked at DOJ, we like to think as the taxpayer, sometimes as our customer, but they are the customer. And so that's something that I think resonated well. And so from the day one, when we're talking about business advice and we're talking about doing certain things in the business, there's always that specter of remember who the entire customer is. So that means we not only do things, you know, according to cost, schedule, we do them according to the contract terms and conditions and all the rules and regulations that go with that. So I say all that because I see a lot of companies that have these fledgling compliance programs that are not proactive, they're not built into the business, and it does take work to get there. But if you don't have that, if my shipbuilders don't see something written down like a compliance plan with all the stuff they need to do, all the training that they need to do, and they're constantly, you know, refreshing that, it's not going to get done. And so that's what we need for our company. But that helps us tailor specific requirements for specific jurisdictions, whether it's states, districts, whatever it is, and be proactive in how we go about doing that. And you couple that with lawyers who want to work for something bigger than themselves, and they want to not only have a strong core legal expertise, whether that's litigation or employment, whatever it is, but also know how to solve problems in more sophisticated ways, in more creative ways, not just in Article III courts, not just filing lawsuits, but also using your ledge affairs, using your HR, going out and meeting partners in the regulatory community, including the law enforcement community, getting all of that, and then you can go out and solve problems, and you can proactively mitigate risk in your company. So that's the way I think about it.
Chad, thank you. And thanks all of you for those opening remarks. To just shifting gears a little bit from the very real, tangible world that Chad lives in to a very literally intangible world, digital currencies. And just bear with me for a second. The company Coinbase, anybody here work for Coinbase? Anybody here familiar with Coinbase? This gets the red blue state issues and on the hot button issues. This is where I'm going with this. In 2020, kind of after the after the summer of the George Floyd riots and so on, you know, in that time you had so many companies venturing out of areas that were core to their business, making statements about issues in America, you know, systemic racism, et cetera. And this became, you know, I Lululemon would have a statement on this, right? Everybody would, you know, everyone would have a statement on this. Coinbase, you know, certainly in Silicon Valley, which is where Coinbase is based, all companies had statements like that, and the employees were demanding that the companies issue these statements. Brian Armstrong, who's the CEO of Coinbase, issued what I always say the Coinbase Manifesto, and this was sort of in late 2020. And he said essentially, I think it was entitled "Coinbase is a mission-focused company." And he essentially said, you can go look at it, just look at Coinbase Manifesto, look it up and Google it and you'll get it. But he says, listen, we are not gonna do that stuff at Coinbase. Right? We'll weigh in on issues that are germane to our business, such as the regulation of digital currency on a state basis, on a federal basis, internationally. But we're not gonna get involved in these non-core issues, even though they could be extremely important to society, to our competitors, and even to you as employees. And so we're just not doing that. It's short, quick, but that was a big step for him to do this. And you know, and he also said, listen, so I'm declaring that now. Many of you may have come to Coinbase to work here, and you thought this is an important part of what Coinbase does or what corporations ought to do. So I'm letting you know now, if you no longer want to be a part of Coinbase because we're getting rid of this stuff, you can leave and we'll give you some severance so you can go on your way and go work for a company that does, a more typical company that gets involved in these things. But now it's anybody coming in to Coinbase now knows that Coinbase, you know, every other company in Silicon Valley could be getting into these issues, and Coinbase is just going to be right down the middle. And apparently something like 60 employees actually left because it was an important enough, essentially, component of their compensation is the way I think about it. Some of their compensation was seeing their corporation take a stand consistent with their stand on issues they care about. I get it. I get that that's a form of psychic compensation. They decided that was important enough that they didn't want to be with Coinbase forever. But why is to the general counsels, to Harold, why is Coinbase such an outlier in that? That seems so logical to be, you know, down the middle, just get involved on a lobbying standpoint or amicus brief standpoint on issues that are core to your business. Why is there so much pressure on companies to do the opposite?
Well, a couple of observations. And first of all, I thought you were going with the whole FTX thing that's happening right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Look, if you look at what we're talking about at its essence, it's corporate speech. And you see what's developed since Citizens United, right? I mean, that a lot of commentary is based on, you know, what's happened in the wake of that decision. I think that there's just a lot of variance in terms of what companies do. Companies are very different in terms of their customer base. They're different in terms of their workforce. And they're all making decisions one way or the other in terms of whether to speak out publicly or not. But it is a First Amendment right for these companies. You know, I think where we're at the chamber is there are First Amendment rights that should be preserved. It's just you should let the market forces really decide as to whether this is right or not. And certainly
let Coinbase
not
have that stance and let other companies have a more aggressive stance.
Yeah, because you know, companies are governed differently. They have different boards, they have different shareholder pressures and different business models. And so, you know, ultimately let the markets play that role, but don't let the heavy hand of government, when we talk about red states or blue states, really interfere in that, because I think that gets us to a point where our free enterprise system could significantly suffer.
You know, one of the things, sorry, I've got a question over here.
Sir, yes.
Yeah. Hi, Ted.
Good to see you. Yep.
Ed Hurst.
Yep. Great, we usually see each other in California.
Yeah.
Yep.
Still.
Yep, good.
So, I wanted to ask you guys a question, following up on really what Ted said and the last comments, too. So much of what companies do seems to be based employees, in particular, the most activist ones, who pound the CEO with a bunch of emails. And the CEO just sort of wants to go away and then takes the position they want. And is sort of the liberal activism you see an effect of the divorce between ownership and control? And even the, when you hear from some of the owners, the shareholders are the most activist ones. And is there some kind of reform that more links ownership and control? So maybe don't allow companies to do, the CEOs get a lot of discretion to take political positions, somehow link that to shareholders. And an analogous point is the whole ESG era. There's a huge pressure on companies to do ESG, from employees and from activist shareholders. All that, A, do you have to do it, and B, all that money tends to go towards the far left causes. I know somebody who's trying to set one of those up, unfortunately, more middle of the road things. But ESG seems another topic of time. And it all seems to be derived from, at least the companies I've been in, CEOs desire just to avoid the hassle of either the activist shareholders or the employees, not because the owners really think that's better for the company's financial interests.
Any thoughts, comments?
Well, I do think the point about employees driving it is spot on. I mean, it's really the employees, and I guess the question is you know, how many of the employees want a particular thing. For our company, I know, and I know for other companies that in the general counsel community, we're having this conversation about, you know, the duty to the shareholders versus the duty to the stakeholders. That's where this game is being played. But more than that, there is a, I think you're going to see companies leaning back on their values, their core values, mm-hmm. in making these decisions. And if a particular social conversation needs to be had, the filter through which to view that will be the values of the company. Now, in our society, I think more and more we values are viewed differently by different people. But nonetheless, that's where we're starting. And I know that's the case for my company and other companies as well. If it doesn't meet with our values, then we're probably, or if it does, if it's not relevant to our values, then we're probably not going to speak to it. You know, unless, of course, you know, the leader of the company has his or her own ability to do that. But that's kind of the guidepost that at least we're focused on.
Yeah, and I'll reiterate that on the mission side as well. As I mentioned earlier, our view is a higher standard of care. We are still privately held. We are female founded and led to this day. Most of our caregiver community, both on our company owned store and our franchise owned store, are women. A very large percentage of our franchisee owners, in part or often majority, are women who took on this business because they wanted to be their own, you know, breadwinner, wanted their own company, their own business. And then you add to that our typical client contact is the adult daughter. And you're seeing a theme that I'm bringing through here. And so what we find a lot of our focus in this space is women empowerment, working with women, finding opportunities for our caregivers to whether, educational opportunities so they can move up the career pathways of healthcare, particularly home care through licensure, and things of that nature. And it really, you see a lot of tie back to what are the values, what are the focus, I'll tell you, during the pandemic, I mentioned this Joint Commission accreditation concept. During the pandemic, our brand was ahead because we already had a hand washing policy for all of our agencies, and that sounds so basic now that we think about it 2 years later, but that had not been a standard in a lot of places. And so lifting up the standard of care, both internally with how we approach our clients, as well as community-wide, has been a really big focus for us.
So I think one other way to think about it, particularly at some of the largest corporations, you know, you're going to be in a situation where it's not just a particularly active employee base, but it's a very active employee base of a particular country. And you may have very, very different views of diversity in the United States as opposed to India or China. And so a CEO is also often in the situation of balancing these different types of competing concerns that are global as well. And one of the things that I think a company can do and consider is stopping short of, for example, R&D decisions that are based on flavor of the month, but thinking about how do you establish and use a foundation. Like a foundation can be a very legitimate way to enter into the public discourse, to be responsive to employees, and be responsive to your duties to your shareholders to, at the end of the day, drive shareholder value, or give your employees a day off to do whatever they would like to do. But by the way, then make it a safe space that if someone wants to go volunteer at their conservative church, that they can go volunteer at their conservative church, and that that is going to be equally acceptable as a day of service for an employee. But from the legal perspective, what I kept coming back to, and I had the benefit and joy of watching an extremely ethical company like Caterpillar take on energy transition. And energy transition in the ESG space and the competing pressures there are extraordinary. But what you need to be advising on is, look, you've gone to the market with a certain set of metrics, with a certain set of how you're going to make money, how you are going to drive shareholder value, and you take money based on that from the public. So what you can't do is take money on the basis of one set of priorities and metrics and then change it behind the covers or in a way that is not transparent to the street. And I think that's a way for lawyers to drive healthy discussions internally about resource allocation, about public statements. And it works in particular at public companies where you do have the, you know, decades of track record on here's how we're going to deliver shareholder value. And that is and should be an anchor for the company on that allows them to kind of buffer and withstand some of the current pressures. I also would say there's a hilarious article that came out, I want to say this summer, probably Wall Street Journal, and it was titled something along the lines of, does my mayonnaise need a mission statement? And of course, the Wall Street Journal's perspective was, no, your mayonnaise does not. Just like, give me a mayonnaise. But you see it and you can watch some of the evolution, like Unilever. To Unilever's credit, they said no. And they went to the market and they said, we are going to be out there on every single cause. And gosh darn it, our mayonnaise does have a mission statement and we're going to make the world better. And you saw some of the economic repercussions for that. And there's pressures that maybe that's not the way to do it. You can also explore a public benefit corporation. There are ways to do all of this. But I think when you're in-house, the desire to react to the employees is real. The desire to retain them is real. And helping folks think through solutions that also make sure you are continuing to maximize shareholder value.
One area where this comes up. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. Go ahead, please. Or yep, there to my left.
Hi, Will Trachten from Mountain Vista Legal Foundation out in Colorado. Last year, Coca-Cola announced that they were going to engage in race discrimination with regard to outside counsel selection. And a little bit after that, they backed off of that. Their GC left. What strategies should GCs have internally when higher-ups are hoping to engage in race discrimination in hiring and promoting within? And as consumers, is there something that we ought to do, either boycotts or shedding light on these situations in order to push back against race discrimination?
Yeah, I think some of that goes to what Beth was just talking about in the context of ESG, of inform, you're just saying, okay, look, I get it that you're trying to do this. I'm sure you're not, you don't realize that you're engaging in racial discrimination on this, but you are, if these are overtly racial metrics that you're putting in there, or at least the very strong claim can be that that's what we're doing. And so, you know, this is probably a well-intentioned idea on your part, you know, my CEO, but we can't do that. And that would be a place, or you know, we take the very strong risk of doing that. And by the way, I, as general counsel, might lose my job if I do this in the legal department, as happened, I believe. My recollection is that that's what happened in the Coca-Cola case. So I think that's one where you'd say, listen, this is, you know, this is taking a massive risk, right?
Well, I will comment on that because I'm pretty passionate about this. I don't want my in-house lawyers and I don't want those on my outside counsel bench all looking like me. And so I'm not gonna put metrics in place, but at the same time, I want my company to be a place where women and people of color, including white men, can succeed in their careers. And so we focus on that. I tell my outside counsel firms, don't send me a package with somebody who's of color on there who's not gonna have meaningful work. So they need to have meaningful work if they're gonna work for us. They don't care what your color is. But if we're doing our job, then everybody should have a chance to work, at least for my company. And so I'm very passionate about it. And if I see, you know, teams that all look like me, then that's where I'll have a conversation with them. It's not metrics. It's not, you know, it's just, that's the way I'm pretty passionate about that. So.
Hey, Chad, I would just add that there's actual data that reinforces the proposition that legal teams that have diversity have better results, better output. And something that I know a lot of major law firms, not only here, you know, in DC, but all across the country, are looking at creating diverse teams, whether it's in litigation or compliance and elsewhere.
I mean, my standard is give me your best lawyers. And if you hold true to that standard and you're looking in the right places, you're gonna have a diverse group. So again, it's not about metrics with me. It's about, I wanna be in, I had a room of 100 people right after COVID we met, and it was all my law department and most of the outside counsel folks that we use. And I just remember looking out and saying, we've got some more work to do, but this room looks a lot better than it did 5 years ago, because we have been saying, give me your best lawyers. And that means people of all walks of life.
On the right, sir.
Yeah, hello. My name is Matthew Kinch. Currently serve as GC and CCO of an independent mortgage bank. And I find this panel to be very fascinating because the struggle is real. When you're looking at state banking agencies in red states, in blue states, my question to you is, because of the heightened collaboration between state agencies from one state agency to another, in addition to like the CFPB, for example, in that vertical collaboration, in your respective industries, have you developed any strategies from not looking at it in terms of this state is in their own camp, this state is in their own camp, but rather they're actually coming at you in a collaborative way?
I can give sort of it's also not unique to state versus state. Like if you think about taxing authorities around the world, they actually will work together and they will collaborate and they will, request information from one taxing authority to the other. And in terms of risk mitigation, one of the things you do need to make 1,000% sure is you're saying the same thing to both. And that's just a fundamental, because they're going, if they are working together, the data needs to be clean, the data needs to be consistent, because that's just an unnecessary self-imposed disaster in the middle of an enforcement situation. And I think people sometimes play to the audience and feel like they may have one set in a particular way to one regulator, overthinking the regulator's position, and a different set in a different way, they may be collaborating. They may exchange that information, and then you're gonna spend the next 6 months explaining why you gave false data to one or the other. But I don't think it's a bad idea to assume that there may be collaboration, and also to assume that information you provide to one regulatory agency is going to end up in the hands of another regulatory agency.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, coming at it from having been in a state agency, yeah, where we did partner not only with our immediate border sister states, but we had an association. And we would share best practices and ideas, not necessarily individual cases, but we would learn kind of what companies were doing to try and avoid their UI taxes, or things of that nature. We learned a lot to help companies too, especially on the workforce side. You know, again, that's where I also heavily advocate, you know, when you're not talking individual cases, but you're talking about relationships with those entities, your associations are really helpful. You know, I rely very heavily on the Home Care Association of America, where we have state chapters, and monthly we come together and the leaders of each chapter, state chapter, talk about what's going on in their state. And you do see the synergies, and you can tell based on what the members from the state are talking about, which states are talking to each other and which states are talking to each other, right? And you see the themes across states. So again, I think from an educational and awareness, leveraging your colleagues, your industry, really does help you not only see where those spots are, but then you can send that association in and do some education. And you can open the lines of communication, because sometimes they're seeing things one way, you're seeing things another way, and if you just sit and talk, there's a middle ground where it's not as contentious.
And I would agree with everything that Beth and Cheryl just talked about. I would also kick in a big variable here, and that is the increasing rise of cities, counties, municipalities getting much more involved in regulating the corporate community. We've certainly seen a bevy of public nuisance lawsuits all across the country in a lot of different areas. And the coordination function, I think, is something that we all have to presume is happening. And so how do you actually see the tea leaves in terms of what's going next? And I just want to make sure that that is part of this problem and equation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sir?
Roman Garris, Committee for Justice. First of all, thank you for a wonderful panel today. It's been really, really informative and really cool. I was curious, you mentioned Coinbase, which was fined $100 million by the SEC for dealing in unregistered securities, what I'm sure was a complete coincidence. It had nothing to do with their statement. We see this sort of backdoor enforcement using other types of tools, where it seems like it's increasingly becoming part of the conversation that every part of the federal government that interacts with the corporation is supposed to make it follow certain goals or social objectives. And now that there have been this spate of new rulemaking at the FTC, I'm curious if you see antitrust as coming into that conversation and how you would react to that. I mean, obviously, probably not thrilled, but you know, what you think should be done about that.
Well, I think competition policy is definitely a central focus for the Biden administration. I mean, you look at their competition EO, which is absolutely breathtaking, and now you see what's happening at the FTC and some of these, you know, the Department of Justice when it comes to challenging mergers and acquisitions and, you know, the broader narrative of moving away from the consumer welfare standard, which has really defined American jurisprudence and antitrust law for like decades. And so this neo-Brandeisian sort of movement on competition policy.
Hipster antitrust.
Some of these European concepts. I mean, this is a huge flashpoint of a fight that is going to happen between, you know, the agencies as well as the business community.
It's also the U.S. in some ways catching up with other jurisdictions. Other jurisdictions, I think, have been much more open about using fair competition policy in different ways. And, you know, fair competition, the list that I referred to, things that keep me up at night, it's a really, really powerful tool for regulators, because as soon as you have something that's rule of reason or inherently subjective, it's difficult to advise your clients. And there's a lot of gray in the fair competition area. And so you have to be transparent on, okay, yeah, please don't sit in a room and discuss prices. But by the way, you know, there's a whole gamut of things. And in any company of any size, there's also going to be a document that you wish someone had not put in writing. And well-meaning people put things in writing, not understanding what it could turn into in the hands of a regulator. And so if you combine changing policy, more affirmative use of the policy, gray rules, and antitrust is one where you don't even really need to complete the act. You have to have an intent to dominate. You may not even have to be successful at it. The stray documents can keep you in an enforcement situation or into a regulatory situation for 10 years. And so it's a scary proposition, I think.
And I think we need to be cognizant that it's not just in the competition space. I think there has been a lot of talk about that. But we see it in a lot of the, I mean, I certainly see it across a lot of the employment agencies as well. And this is an area where I go back to Chad's point about trust with your business people. Mm-hmm. Because when you go to your business people and have to tell them that they have to do something different than they've done for decades, and why is this suddenly a problem, that is a very tough conversation to have. It is very hard to explain to them why you are changing on a dime what you are saying is risky and not. And being able to tell them the narrative of this is where we were, this is what is going on atmospherically, and this is the result of how we have to change behavior, that is a hard conversation. And not only do you have to have that trust, but you have to lay the groundwork of not just telling them this is what you need to do now, but why in the history.
We got about 5 minutes, so let's try to get two more in. Sir, in the red tie, you've had your hand up. Yep, that's you.
I'm Bruce Foster. So it seems like we got such a disagreement at the beginning. Ted giving us kind of the black letter of the lawyer has to separate the two, past management and law. We all kind of get that. And then Chad saying, you know, as you learn to grow, you can kind of do it, or maybe mushing the two of them together. But I think the left has been doing that for a while. I think with ESG, maybe it's an activist shareholder, then it's CalPERS, then it's a regulation codifying. So at the front end, you're like, wow, it's not a legal requirement. But then you say, it's not a legal requirement, but it might be one soon, too. It's about to be one, too. It actually is one. So I guess, and then you guys talk about antitrust, and every area of the law seems to be much more holistic. All of these social policies are being put through every regulatory area. With all that being said, it seems to me like the only silver bullet that we have, besides from massive illegal shift or actual trade associations that do good work, would be something like Florida. You may not like what they do in any given circumstance, but they're providing you the air cover to kind of, opportunistically shoot down some of these things. So I was wondering, isn't there some advantage to certain red states that might put more onerous regulatory requirements in one individual case, but it has a large effect on just the legal culture generally, in the absence of any other coordination that you have?
Was that directed at me?
To anybody, yeah.
Your general view on,
I think the question is, to what end? Where is this going to be headed? Okay, perhaps for a policymaker in Tallahassee, it addresses a certain need. But what's going to happen in a blue state in retaliation?
And vice versa. Right.
I mean,
if Newsom comes up with something, red states are going to retaliate.
Look, I've done state lobbying in the past, and my observations of the state compared to Washington is that things move pretty quickly. Committee meetings, markups, boom, it's signed into law. And for a company, how do you adjust to these things? I mean, they're dealing with Washington where they're getting whipsawed through executive orders and administrative action that don't go through the normal channels where, you have people who have to vote on things like in Congress. And so I think that is the core of what the problem is here, is that, okay, is there an immediate need to be addressed here? And if that happens, what's going to happen in 5 years, 10 years from now? And again, to my original point, what does that mean to the rule of law? And for companies trying to navigate some of these really, really complex areas when there is a, this type of reaction to what's happening, And so, I think that should be considered in the long term.
I think this was an ancillary point, but I want to clarify to the extent that I was not clear on it. I think everybody on this panel probably has a little different view of how active lawyers should be in the business. I think everybody would agree, however, that you need to be very clear when you're giving business and legal advice for another panel. But, the assault on the attorney-client privilege is prevalent. It's being held pretty good in the Article III courts. Got a good Kavanaugh mandamus decision. We've got Henry grand jury, I think is the name of the case, going in front of the court this term. But that's something we really need to pay attention to. And I'm not sure in the in-house community, particularly those in multinational corporations, do a good job. But just to be clear, when you're giving legal advice, it needs to be crystal clear that that's what it is.
And I think we all agree that's one of the funnest things about going in-house.
Yeah.
Is that you get to embed with the business and you get to learn the
business. Part of the point of it.
That's
part of the attraction.
That's the fun of going in-house.
Yeah. you're part of a mission, you're part of a company. And one way to think about, you know, in terms of the business and legal overlap, you know, the way I always thought about it is, especially if you got a new growing company, Facebook at the time, you know, legal risk is just one type of risk that faces this company. A massive risk is getting blown up tomorrow by Google because they come out with a much better product. And if we sit around worrying, or going into the metaverse, right, and doing that, but if you focus excessively on a legal risk that could be, hey, if we roll out this product, we may get hit by a patent lawsuit by Yahoo.
Sure.
Okay, that's a risk. But if we don't roll out this product, they'll probably beat us to the punch, and I'd rather defend that case in court than be out of work.
And it's not necessarily, it's not necessarily binary, right? Sometimes you're just taking as much risk out as you can.
Yeah.
And I think I created the role that I'm in right now, and the COO did not want a lawyer in-house. And 9 months later at our annual planning, we had to go around the room and say what was the best thing that happened this year. And he said the hiring of me. And that's because I spent a lot of time with him saying, how can I help? What are you trying to accomplish here? Can I suggest a way that mitigates risk but still accomplishes what you want?
Perfect.
Spending a lot of that conversation makes a big difference.
Solutions oriented.
Last question at the mic over here, sir.
Hi, I'm Sam Miarelli at Siemens Energy. Hearing the conversation you guys had kind of about some of these woke capitalism topics and all, it goes along with the discussion of Kirkland at the last panel, of where at some level size becomes the enemy and becomes kind of this weird homogenizing force that pushes some of these cultural things into the business. And I think we're guilty of it just as much as any big multinational. Because very few of the markets we litigate in is Jones Day or Kirkland or whoever really got the best lawyer in that market. But God help us as in-house counsel to find the mid-sized firm that's really got the superstar. And I was just wondering for the panel, if this is something that you guys think about as you're thinking about your own panels and any ideas you have on how we can move the needle at some of these big companies to diversify our panels, not just in what they look like on the brochure, but what kind of organizations as far as law firms we're hiring.
I'll tell you one thing I do is I will sit through a lot of webinars where I won't necessarily always get credit for it because I'm doing something else. But if I see a lawyer that presents on a topic that I think does a good job or that I think I'll go and say I want that lawyer to help me. And if someone does a good job at a meeting, no matter how junior they are or not the salesperson or the whatever we call it, relationship partner, I'll say I want X to do this for me. And I'll ask for individual attorneys, but I'll kind of seek out different folks that they might not have necessarily put in front of me and say, this is who I want to try for this. Let me have this person for this. And in that way, it does allow me to give some folks who are waiting their turn a chance. Now, that's within a law firm. I mean, you could do a similar thing if you're trying to find other law firms. It's just sitting on their webinars. I mean, sometimes looking at their materials, listening to them talk, you can get a sense as to whether they know what they're talking about. And a lot of times, some of these areas are so technical, you need the technocrat, not the big thought leader. And that's something I always try and keep an eye on.
And sometimes you may be able to make a budget play.
Yes.
Because you know, there's an instinct from the board all the way down that they've done the right thing. They've hit their fiduciary duty. They've hired Kirkland. And God bless Kirkland. I have hired Kirkland when I have needed Kirkland. And they bring a whole lot to the table. I also started at Cooper and Kirk. So I also see the value of a very small, nimble law firm. And I think we're going to see more of those as you see the mega firms becoming perhaps less hospitable to folks. I think there's going to be that opportunity, and there is an opportunity for in-house lawyers, but there's a progression. You would be in a tough spot giving an unknown your bet the company litigation unless and until they've got a track record. But I also think multinationals, you know darned well, like it's not going to be the majors. You're going to have to find local counsel anyways. Who knows who's Beck Law? And so there's actually more of a familiarity and I think a willingness to trust. You need the right lawyer for the right case. But that is somewhere where you can and should, as an in-house attorney, think about getting the right fit for the right time and not just the, not going to end on a, not just the safe, safe decision to bring on a mega law firm.
I think that your question is a superb one, I think, and really ties together some of the themes that we, I think we started off the panel that you heard throughout. You know, the Kirkland episode, I think, was outrageous. It's a terrible moment in the law, what Kirkland did to Paul. I think that's probably a widely held view. But you know, I say that as a former Kirkland partner. I think it was just, it's not the Kirkland that I, it's not the Kirkland I grew up in that would do that. And I think there is a real linkage to the in-house counsel and to this management role of the management and law role in-house counsel, because supposedly, or you know, I guess what you hear from the Kirkland episode is, well, and this is certainly what happened also to Paul at the, when he was defending the Defense of Marriage Act at King and Spalding back in the day. The idea was, well, you know, this is so unpopular what you're doing representing, you know, gun companies a pro Second Amendment view in Bruin and then in King and Spalding DOMA, right? Mm-hmm. This is so bad that, you know, pick a company. These are probably not correct, but big company X is going to yank its business from King and Spalding because we have a guy who is defending DOMA. And then they go to Paul and they say, well, you know, we can't lose that account. That's $50 million a year, right? And to me, that's a great moment when the general counsel, I mean, easy for me to say, not, no longer being it, but you got to stand up at that point, I think, as the general counsel and say, listen, at some point to your CEO, we are going to be the unpopular company on some issue. You name it, we're going to have the bullseye on us. And at that point, I want the best firm, it may be Kirkland, it may be King and Spalding, whoever it is, to be representing us. And so we're not going to blacklist firms for representing clients who happen to be unpopular in today's issue du jour and are unpopular in the page of the New York Times. So I think it's to any general counsel who would make that call, you know, to me, that's a resignation moment. Just like Paul, you know, Paul's resignation moment was, if you're telling me to dump a client or dump an issue going forward, then I just can't work at this law firm anymore. I would hope the general counsel had the same view and would go to their, if they got that pressure, and would say, listen, we don't do that. I support defense of unpopular causes. That's core to the mission of a lawyer, you know, the state of the legal profession. We started there. That's core to what lawyers do. And we're not going to be adding to the pressure. We're not going to be telling Kirkland or telling King and Spalding that we're yanking the business because we don't like some other client they haven't represented. And I've been picking on conservative causes and companies that weigh in when you've got somebody. I'd say the same thing if somebody said to, you know, to Covington, hey, we're no longer using Covington because you guys are defending Abu Ghraib, you know, not Abu Ghraib, but, you know, you Guantanamo people, right? You'd say, no, that's, you know, these people are very unpopular now. We're not yanking our business from them. This is the finest tradition of American law. Anyway, I think that's an example of a place where lawyers should have that kind of influence. I get the pressures to not do that, and I get that people like to keep their jobs, but that's, you know, I think it's very easy to push back. Not very easy, but you have a compelling case to push back to your management because you say, look, we'll be in the crosshairs someday. I guarantee it. You can be the most innocuous company. You'll be there someday. You want the best at that point.
So weird. We started with John Adams introducing Ted, and we end with John Adams' principle.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. All right. Thanks very much to our panelists.
Thank you, Ted. Thanks for having us.